Hello, my name is Tiff, and welcome back to the Behind the Collective podcast. This podcast will take you around Australia, where you will meet advocates, influencers, and champions of the livestock industry. Christy is our guest today, who is committed and passionate about the industry. So committed that she has just about spent more time the last few years with her dog observing cows out in the paddock than what she has with humans. Christy Pearson can be spotted in the air, flying around the Northern Territory working on research projects. We chat about her PhD, looking at risk factors for calf mortality in the Northern Australia, how she ended up in the top end, and what she loves about it.
Well, tell us about you. Who are you? Where are you from? What do you do?
So I'm Christy Pearson. I work for the NT department in the livestock industries team in Katherine. I'm the team leader there. So there's seven of us in the team at the moment, and it's an awesome team. We're all women, which is pretty outstanding in itself. And we've all got really good outlooks for the industry. And I think we're a really passionate team. And we love to just get things done and brainstorm projects. And we're really, really passionate team. Really cool to work with people like that. I'm originally from the Blue Mountains, west of Sydney, and I grew up there. I've been in the Territory for 9 years now. So I moved up here in 2016. I started cooking at Heli Muster when I first moved up here. My partner works for Heli Muster, Charlie, so that's why I came up here initially, as I'm sure many people probably do. And yeah, I couldn't cook anything except spaghetti.
Oh, really?
But when I left, I could cook a few more things. So that was my favourite dish, spaghetti bolognese. And yeah, I've been here ever since, done a few things since then, but I'll leave it at that.
Now, the hardest question that we ask everyone is 3 words to describe yourself.
Oof. Yeah, that is hard. I would have to say organised, creative, and happy, probably.
I like that. When the people who nominated you described you as bubbly, so I feel like happy, bubbly, same thing. Now, you came up to the Territory 9 years ago as a station cook. I believe you have done a lot of things since, actually. What are you doing right now? So you've said you're team leader. What does that actually mean? So what does it mean you work for, a department, you're a team leader? What do you do day to day? What does it look like?
Well, as a team leader, I suppose my official role is to mentor and supervise everyone in the team. I am really fortunate that everybody is so capable in my team that we pretty much mentor each other through the hard things. So I don't think many team leaders could probably say that, but I think I can definitely say that for my team. Day to day, it's very different each day. Some days I'm in the office writing codes in R, which is not my favourite thing, but these things have to be done. And some days we could be out at Kibben Springs doing first round mustering, so we could be on a horse, bike, in the yards processing. Other days we might be having meetings with other stakeholders or like research institutions, so CDU or CSIRO or anyone really. We have a lot of good collaborations with people in the industry, so we do a lot of talking, a lot of conversing with other people, and sharing ideas and research proposals and stuff like that.
And so you're quite big in the research game. We met a few years ago. We met at Avern Station, a beautiful Avern with the Boabs as you drive in. Not that you drive, we'll get to this later, but you actually fly around the NT, which I think is pretty incredible. But tell me about this research project you've been working on and what else. I believe there's a few things happening out there at the moment. I want to know about them all.
Well, at Avern, that was sort of the tail end of my PhD when I met you. We were looking at calf mortality and using remote monitoring technologies to identify, I suppose, the risk factors around calf loss. So we had GPS collars on cows, we had vaginal implants in cows, we had solar ear tags, GPS ear tags on cows. We had all sorts of tech going out there at Newry and Auvergne. Mostly was the sort of hub of that project. Very unfortunately named the Mortality Project. Sydney Uni was running that, and I was the PhD student on that project. So I basically just ran the on-ground component of that from Newry. And then we did a couple of seasons at Auvergne as well. So Dave and Ellie were managing Newry when we started that. And then when they moved across to Auvergne, I couldn't let go. So I had to go over there as well and kept going with it there. But yeah, they were amazing. Loved my time there at Newry and Auvergne. So yeah, that was sort of the start of my research career up here, I suppose. I started that in 2017. You know, being alone doing that sort of research out there was pretty tough at times, but I think it was a good learning curve. And yeah, I met a lot of awesome people through those years with the new camps coming in each year.
Yeah,
it was really awesome to have like that sort of yearly new people. And they used to call me the crazy alien girl because I used to ride around on a motorbike with my fluoro orange helmet and a blue VHF tracking device and the dog, and it was just a bit of a show, but anyway.
Tracking your cows.
Yes. It was great fun. It was probably the best 4 years of my life, really.
So I think we skipped some steps, though. You came out initially as the station cook.
Oh,
how
yeah.
did you end up doing your PhD in the mortality project, looking into calf mortalities in the Northern Territory? How did that happen?
Well, actually, I was in the kitchen one day and my supervisor from Sydney Uni from my honours project, he rang me. He's like, "Christy, what are you doing?" I was like, "Oh, I'm cooking in the NT." And he's like, "Oh, do you want to do a PhD?" I was like, "Nah, definitely not." He's like, "Oh, do you want to do a PhD if you could stay in the NT?" And I was like, "Ooh, well, now you're talking." And I sort of thought about it and he discussed it with me, and it all sort of fell together there. And we had a meeting with CPC, who owned Newry, Auvergne and Argyle at the time, and we went down to Brisbane and sat down with them and sort of worked out what place might be the best to do this research on. And they chose Newry, and I was like, "Yep, that's great. That's only a 2.5-3 hour drive from VRD, which is where I was living at Helymuster there." And yeah, it all kind of just fell into place. I wouldn't say it was a planned thing. It wasn't like I was set out to do one, but it just kind of happened.
Yeah. And now, so you were at the tail end then. What the outcomes of that? Where are you at with that specific research project now? And why is it important for those who are down south who say might not have come up here to the territory and seen how extensive it is? Describe why it's a thing. You don't see your cows every day up here.
Mm.
Very different to, say, some farms down south. So why are we even looking into it?
Well, I think it's, you know, the nature of the northern beef industry is that it's so extensive. You don't see your cows, you know, more than maybe twice a year. And you even when you do see them, it's at a herd level or a paddock level. You don't really see them as an individual animal. It's sort of, you know, oh, here's 1,000 head, let's, you know, get this done and wean calves. And, you know, it's all a very large scale process. So I suppose from our point of view, we wanted to try and nut out some of the reasons why these calves were dying. So there's a whole range of different weaning percentages that are coming out across the territory. I mean, up to 40%, no worries, in some places, of calves are dying. So you're getting a 60% weaning rate in some places, probably pretty poor, but, you know, it's definitely there. And that's a huge economic loss. And obviously it's a huge animal welfare concern as well. So especially in this day and age, like, our social license is really important. And that was sort of the driving force, I suppose, behind this research. And it still is. We're still doing research on it. So.
And I think as an industry too, we're always looking at ways to get better.
Yeah.
And this is an industry-driven change. We're asking ourselves, how can we improve? How can we continue to improve? And that's what it comes down. We'll talk about more of the research projects you guys are doing, but that's why these are so important. And I think we underestimate how much research actually is involved in the industry at a national level, because we're always looking, how can we do better? Yeah.
I think it's, you know, a lot of people, unless you're involved in the industry or research, you probably wouldn't have come across, you know, like, there's definitely papers out there that have done research on pretty much, you know, anything you can poke a stick at. There's been some research done, And I suppose for us, like coming back to now in the role that I'm doing now and our team, what we're finding is the hardest part is that extension and adoption. So we're doing the research, we're getting the results, and, you know, we're working with people in the industry and we're seeing what's happening. But it's that, I suppose, getting that information to producers in a way and in a form that they can like tangibly understand and use that information.
And implement.
I mean, it's all well and good to say that you need to do this, but if they haven't, you know, done this or that, they can't do that. And, you know, there's roadblocks every turn you make. So I guess trying to facilitate that uptake of this research is probably one of our biggest challenges as an industry government body. And, yeah, you know, adoption is a long pathway and it just takes time. You know, you can't expect everyone to jump on board with something straight away. They want to see that other people have done it, or they want to see what the cost benefit is, or they want to see the long-term differences between what they're doing and if they did it a different way, and which is totally fair enough. I mean, it's their livelihood for a lot of people, so they want to be sure that it's, you know, definitely on the right track. So, yeah, I think that's where our biggest gains would probably be at the moment in, yeah, extension and adoption.
And so outcome of that specific project, where are you at?
Well, I think it's out now, publicly available. There's a lot in there.
As a PhD, so you don't like know when it's out? You not like pop the bottle of champagne and be like, oh my gosh, there was a lot of years of my life?
Or do you never? One of my weaknesses is not celebrating the small wins, and I think that I should have. I didn't even go to my graduation for my PhD, and I should have, because it was a big part of my life. But no, I think that my thesis is out. It's online if you want to read it.
Yeah, just please tell us where.
Christy Pearson, Sydney Uni, cows or whatever, and it'll come up. Anyway, it's, you know, a lot of it's tech related, so there's a lot of trialing of technologies and seeing how well they can be used in this sort of environment. And yeah, it's not all completely cattle production related. But overall, I think we had some pretty cool findings. We ended up changing some things midway through because we knew that what we were doing wasn't going to work. We couldn't capture calf loss because we weren't collaring the calves at birth. So we had to sort of make a bit of a change in plan and start collaring calves as they were born to track them and see how they moved with their mothers. So we sort of did like a cow-calf proximity chapter in my thesis and did a whole year of that at Newry, which was really interesting. It was a little bit difficult to catch calves sometimes, but it was very
particularly fun. There's a lot of Brahmins up here and I hear they're really good mums. So was it just you out there running around with the bike and the dog and the antenna after the calf? And what did you do your research? Like the day-to-day of actually researching something. So how big's Newry?
Oh, Newry's... good question. The paddock we were doing it in was 33 square K, so it was not huge. And we had a smaller paddock, which was only 7 square K, that we did like the intense calf collaring stuff in. So I would go out probably for 2 months straight. I would be out there for like, I don't know, 3 times a day, maybe a total of like 9 hours a day in the paddock, just literally living with the cows. I bought myself a camp chair from Shelf Supplies in Cunnamulla and I went out there and I had my book and my laptop and the dog and my drink bottle and I sat in the paddock with the cows for many hours, and we had accelerometers on them so I would be recording behaviours as well while I was out there, and I was just waiting for them to calve basically, and then as soon as they calve I'd ride back to the station. I'd be like, right, Dave, we're on, let's go. We'd jump in the buggy and we'd have our specific roles. Dave would be the driver and the cow interferer, and I would be the calf. Actually, sort of varied, I suppose. One of us would grab the calf, the other one would put the collar on, and the other one would look at the cow to make sure she wasn't trying to eat us while we were.
How often did they come after you? For those
actually
who don't know,
very little.
Oh, really? Yeah. I was about to say, I've heard Brahmins are very good mums.
I think we had a good cohort. We only had 30 cows in the paddock, but we only really had one try and have a go at us properly. One of them took off completely. She ended up coming back. We kept an eye on her because we were worried about mismothering, and that was definitely factored in, but we just thought we can't get these answers unless we try this and risk it, and we waited up, and none of them ended up being mismothered from the collaring, so that was a relief. But yeah, a lot of them were, they would just stand back and they would keep it very close eye, but they didn't show a heap of aggression, which was very handy.
Yeah, that is handy.
Mm.
And so it would have been lonely. You said that earlier. So that sounds like a bit of a lonely task, literally sitting out there with cows. Did you, you would be someone who knows a cow and their behaviorisms. What did they do that surprised you? Was there something you learnt out there by looking at the cows?
Well, yes,
you would have spoken cows by the end of it.
I think the biggest takeaway was that every cow is an individual, like a human, and they all operate differently and they all look different and they have different responses to everything. And just that individuality was astounding, I would say. Some cows I got to know really well. They were in the trial for the whole 4 years and they were like my friends, I'm going to say it. I would talk to them and they recognized who I was. And I knew that, you know, this cow is a really good mum. She's going to come for a drink. She's going to have a 2-minute drink and then she's going to walk straight back out to her calf. This cow, she's pretty taking it easy. You know, she's like 8 years old. She knows her calf's going to be fine. She has a drink and she goes and lays in the sun for a bit. And then she goes and talks to Daisy over there and then she'll go back to her calf. And like just the individuality between each was really cool.
Mm.
Mm.
That is fascinating.
But yeah, I do. I'm a bit of a loner, I would say. I'm quite a solitary person. I like my dog. I have my dog with me. She was with me the whole time. So she kept me company. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I just, I really enjoyed it.
And
it
then was great. How did you end up? So you finished up that project. How did you end up then at the, like, we call it, refer to it as the research station here in Catherine? How did that transition happen?
So I'd finished. Well, I was sort of writing up my PhD at the time. When was it? I think I was editing comments from the reviewer, so it would have been October 2021, I think. And I got a call from Tim, who is the director of livestock now, and he was like, oh, yeah, I'm just, you know, calling to see if you're interested in this job. And I was like, oh, yeah, absolutely. Actually, I think Georgia also sent me the link to the job. And yeah. I looked at it and I was like, oh, I'm not qualified to do that. And anyway, one thing led to another. And yeah, that was the end of 2021. And I started just before Christmas and here I am. So it's taken a fair while to get the hang of it. And I'd say I'm only now just starting to feel like I'm doing what the job requires, maybe. Yeah, it was a fairly steep learning curve, like going from working alone in a paddock by myself to managing a group of people. And yeah, I suppose I'd never had any formal like training or, you know, like leadership training or anything like that. So it was a really good challenge. And I mean, so lucky that the team was so great. But yeah.
So we spoke about it briefly before this we started recording. So what are other research projects are happening currently out there now?
Well, we've got probably, you know, many, many, like over 20 projects that have been happening or that are happening or that are in the works at the moment. So I think some of our biggest, most exciting ones that have just finished up, well, Sweet Spot, the Sweet Spot project is probably one of the most amazing ones that has come out recently. That was looking at, that was sort of more of a rangelands focus, looking at utilization rate on breeder performance. So that's, I suppose, really looking at how much grass have you got, how much grass can animals eat, and then what effect does that have on their reproductive performance. So say you've got a mob of cows in a paddock and your utilization rate is 20%. Can those animals perform better than, say, you've got another paddock and those cows have a utilization rate in that paddock of 30%, so they're eating more proportion of the available feed, and just sort of looking at that across different land types and different regions based on animal data. So weight, animal class, age, that sort of thing. So the results from that are, you know, really amazing. And it just shows that I think we need to not forget about the country and the grass and the rangelands side of things when we're looking at our cattle, because cows eat grass and grass is important. And I think it's hard, you know, when you're at this sort of scale, you can't be in control of everything. So I suppose it was just a reminder for everyone that, you know, it's really important to not just look at the cows and to look at what's on the ground and what's supporting and feeding your cows And that obviously flows into your carbs as well. So yeah, the Sweet Spot Project's really cool. Haddock Power Project was one that's just finished up as well. That was sort of looking at the watered area in a paddock and how that affects breeder performance. So if you've got a big paddock with a few waters in it, are your cattle going to do better or worse? And if you've got a paddock with waters every 3K or something, that they, you know, they can easily access all the paddock and then be close to water.
Mm. And what was the outcome?
Well, a bit of a mixed bag, because we had a few things pop up, as you do with science and research in these sort of systems. We had a basically water flowing through the paddock a lot of the time, which sort of threw the results a bit in terms of calculating watered area, because it ended up that half the paddock, like the whole paddock, was watered for a lot of the time. But yeah, I think the, you know, the reproductive performance stuff was sort of leaning towards, you know, big paddocks with not a lot of waters are probably going to impact your reproductive performance, because your cows have got to expend more energy accessing feed and water. Yeah, they're just walking further, using energy. But obviously that, you know, there's a cost benefit there as well. So you can say that, but then if you're going to spend $20 million putting in infrastructure, then it's not really going to be worth your while. So that's why the project developed this calculator as well. And it's like a user-friendly Excel calculator, basically, and also a mapping tool on QGIS. And you can go in there, map your paddock out, put in the potential infrastructure that you want to do, so like adding a trough, adding a pipeline, adding a fence, for instance, and then it tells you, like, you put in all your details, like your carrying capacity, how many head you've got in there, how big the paddock is, what land type, and then it spits out, you know, your return on investment, basically. It gives you something tangible to say, it's going to be worth my while and I'm going to get this many more, you know, weaners out of my herd if I do this, and it's going to cost me this. So
that's it. So where can the listeners find that?
That's on our page as well. We've sort of in the final stages of going through our funding body with that. So it's not completely out yet. The QGIS mapping plugin is out, so you can play around with that. It's free to download. You just need to download QGIS, which is a free software. And yeah, just contact us, like, if you want to talk about any of that or how to use a tool, you can contact us. At the
how
department.
To speak cow, I think. Speak I think you cow. Would be a cow whisperer by this point. Yeah. And we spoke about it briefly before too. Another research project you're working on is flies.
Yeah, sorry, I got so embedded into all these other ones that I forgot about the other ones. Yeah, no, the fly tag. We've got a few different fly tag ones that have happened recently and one that's starting up as well. So we've just had, in the last few months, a lot of issues with exporting cattle with any lesions. So we're knocking back 40% of animals based on lesions, which aren't necessarily to do with, you know, lumpy skin, which is what they're worried about. So lumpy skin's obviously on our doorstep, and exporting regulations are getting pretty strict with it. So for
those who don't know, how do you define a lesion? So, and we've got, yeah, a lot of cattle out of the north, well, all of them really, head over to, say, Indo, this big market where they're really worried about lumpy skin and all skin lesions. But what is a skin lesion?
Well, it's like a blemish. So say, you know, you've got a mozzie bite and you've picked a scab, and, you know, now it's like a visible sort of blemish on the skin. So it's not, if the animal doesn't have a smooth, homogenous coat, anything that's disrupting that. So like a bit of scar tissue, bit of discoloration, even like a discoloration of the fur that's grown back over the top of a lesion or a blemish, like that's even getting knocked back. So yeah, there's sort of anything that's basically interrupting the homogenous nature of the coat of the animal, I suppose, is what you would classify. And it can be from buffalo fly, it can be from lice, it can be from other biting insects. It's not just from buffalo fly. But I suppose we need to sort of address that as an industry, because it's a pretty important thing. If we can't export, you know, a huge amount of cattle, that's going to have massive flow-on effects. If cattle have to be brought back to stations, or if they're going to, you know, be sold locally, they're going to have a huge price drop selling to local abattoirs. So yeah, that's like a pretty impactful issue, I would say. So yeah, we're just sort of trialing a few different things. There's different insecticidal tags that can be used, like ear tags that can deter flies. So yeah, trialing a few of them, seeing what impact that has on not only weight gains in the animal, because obviously the fly burden, they're shaking their heads and they're flicking their ears and trying to get the flies away, that's going to impact their weight and how they can put on weight. And then also the fly tags are, we're trying to see if there's a reduction in lesions or blemishes on the skin based on the use of the fly tags or other methods. So like there's this sulfur and garlic lick that Olsen's have. Going to start looking into that, or just, you know, manual back rubbers and that sort of thing as well.
So there's a lot happening always in the research area. What do you wish as a researcher, if you could like say something to like graziers or farmers or at a grassroots level, what do you wish you could get across? What key message? Because I feel like it's always been a thing within the ag industry where we've almost not separated the two. I think there's a thing within the ag industry where there's a huge divide between the two. So research is something you're clearly very passionate about. What do you wish you could say to graziers or farmers?
I suppose there's sort of a long-term disconnect between research or between scientists and industry, and for a number of reasons. I think firstly, you know, sometimes when scientists get into their little science speak, it can be quite hard to understand, or, you know, it's a bit confusing, or, you know, not necessarily meaningful to producers. I think it would be great if, you know, we had a better connection. I think we do, isn't it? Like, I think particularly here, we have a really good rapport at a general level with producers in this area. But I think one of the hardest things to connect science through to industry is like that communication between the two. So I suppose my piece of hope would be that we keep talking to each other, like industry and research keep talking to each other, because that's the way we develop what we can work on together, and that's the way we can move forward. And we're all wanting the same thing. I think we just have different ways of getting there. And if we work together and keep communicating, then hopefully we can get there.
Definitely, because we all want to achieve the same goal, I think. You know, everyone has a passion for the industry.
Yeah.
Now, my next question, let's talk about the plane. A lot of people have said since I've moved up to the Northern Territory, there's this really cool chick who goes and looks at calves, who flies around in the plane. So how did you end up? So you've got a plane. I'm sure there's some technical things with the plane, about the plane, that people would love to hear. How did you end up with a plane flying around the territory as a mode of transport?
Well, it's actually quite simple, I suppose. We're living at VRD, Victoria River Downs. It's 4 hours from Katherine to drive, and it's over the Buchanan, which is notoriously one of the roughest roads, I would say, up here. I drove to Newry over the Buchanan like every fortnight for 4 years. So I've done a fair few Ks, and when I finished my PhD, I thought, you know, Christy, this is, you know, you're going to need a plane. It was a very, like, matter of fact, you can't drive and you're going to have to get a job. You can't work here, so you're going to have to go to town. So I was like, well, I mean, obviously living at Helimuster with pilots, it was like a bit of a natural progression. It wasn't like, you know, plane out of nowhere. Yeah, so one of the pilots that used to work there, he was selling his plane, and I was like, oh yeah, we should buy that plane. So we did, and then I finished my PhD on the 30th of June, and on the 1st of July I went down to Camden and I started my plane license, and it took me 5 weeks, got my PPL, and yeah, love my little Cherokee. It's pretty slow, but it's very economical, and it gets me to where I need to go. And the dog loves it, which is the main thing. So the dog takes high priority in my life, if you haven't already guessed that. So, yeah, I think it was pretty natural progression for me to do that. I mean, it was very scary and very challenging at times, but I'm sort of one of those people who's like, okay, yep, you need to do that, and I just go and do it, and then it's done. So it was just a box to tick, I suppose, to give me the lifestyle and the freedom that I have, because I still live at VRD and I still commute between Katherine and VRD. So that's like an hour and a bit flight. I try and do a few weeks in town, a few weeks there, but it's just very flexible because I can just go wherever I need to go. And yeah, the road and the flood will not pull me up.
Yeah. That's a benefit here. We've had a really good wet season. So yes. When everyone else was stuck, you were sweating around coming into town to get a coffee.
Well, the road was closed for weeks and weeks. So, yeah, I was actually overseas for 3 months. So I don't know what happened this wet season. I've only just got back. But, yeah, it's very handy having a plane. I don't think it's not as unusual up here as it might sound to people down south. Like, I think it's a fairly... not common, but it's very accepted. And it's, you know, kind of normal.
I just I love that you just use yours though. I don't know, just in instead of a car.
Yeah. Well, I said to my partner, I was like, it doesn't even matter if the car's broken down. Like, I need the plane because I can't get anywhere without the plane. If I don't have a car, you know, that's fine. I can just walk to work from town, from the airport or something. But I need the plane to get home.
And so, where's your favourite place that you've seen from above in the territory?
Oof, that's a hard one.
It would be beautiful up there, surely.
The territory is like such a blank canvas, and everywhere you look, you can't see anything in terms of like there's no population anywhere. Like, it's just all landscape. And I, you know, flying into work this morning, there was like a layer of clouds just above us, and we were like, the sun was coming up, and we were looking over the VRD region, and there was like gorges and the water was everywhere. And I was like, oh, this is like one of those moments when you don't realize at the time how cool it is. And then, you know, 2 years later, you'll be like, wow, I really miss doing that or whatever. I'd say my favorite area is probably home, the VRD. I love that area, like the Gregory between like Timber Creek and VRD. That's really pretty there. There's also some cool spots up around Kakadu, like Cooinda. There's some pretty cool like places there. Oh, and then Avern, like the Baines and the Vic, and when they meet and they go out to the ocean. Oh, really hard. All of it. Bradshaw, like everywhere. The territory's great. And even like the desert has its own special little, I mean, there's not much to look at, but it's pretty amazing, just that vastness.
Yeah. And I feel like I've got to backtrack a little bit. Where did you grow up? You said in the Blue Mountains. Did you grow up on a farm?
No, not a farm. I mean, it was a bit of a hobby farm, probably. It was 40 acres in the Blue Mountains. We had horses and sheep and goats and chooks and dogs. And, yeah, I was a very animal sort of aggy person, but it wasn't like a farm.
And
mum and dad were flight attendants for Qantas their whole life. So. Definitely not. They're not farmers.
Yeah, and because it seems. How did you meet Charlie? I'm going to ask this all again, but I feel like, did you guys meet at uni and then you came up here and then?
No, we met at a scholarship test for our high school when we were 11.
Oh, high school sweethearts.
Yes. Well, we went together in high school, but we met when we were 11 and.
11 years old.
Yes. Yes, 11. Then we went to high school together, but we were never together until we were 19.
Yeah. So you grew up on a little hobby farm down south.
Mm-hmm.
You met your partner when you were 11 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And then where did you go to uni and then go out cooking?
So we finished school in 2011. Charlie went to Kimberley, to Jubilee Downs, Jack Rewing. And then I went to uni straight from school. So I did ag science at Sydney Uni as my undergrad. And then, finished that in 2015. And then in 2016, I went to the territory.
So started cooking, got the phone call to do the PhD.
Yes.
And then it's all flowed on from there.
And it's just rolled. It's just snowballed. Yes. Yeah, it's good. Really, you need to stop and really assess what's going on.
And then, so you've described the territory from above. What else is it? You're still up here. The territory is a very transient place. People come, they go. What else is it that you love up here? Do you see yourself up here long term?
Look, I could stay here forever. I mean, it's kind of like, I mean, I said this to a few people before, but it feels like the territory is like the last frontier in that there's so many things that haven't been achieved or discovered, and there's so many challenges that everybody can have a shot at. Like, it's not some, you know, you don't go to the city and you work with 1,000 other people in an office doing the same thing every day. Like, everything in the territory is open for opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what makes it special. And people feel like they are achieving something here that's tangible and that's special. And I think that's why people stay or love it, maybe. Obviously, you know, it's got its downsides as well. Being so remote, you're far from friends and family if you're interstate, or access to certain things. If you're a city person, it's probably the worst place in the world that you'd want to come. But yeah, I think I love it just because it's different and it's got opportunity, and yeah, it's sort of a bit untouched.
I love that. Life out of VRD, I was just thinking about it. So how many, it's like a little community within itself though out there. So how many of you live out there?
So there's Helimaster. This is confusing, so I'll try and break this down. So VRD is obviously the station, and they have their own crew and they have their own cook and everything, like they're sort of their own entity. And then Helimaster has a portion there on VRD, and that's where Helimaster's mustering base is. So, yeah, we've got heaps of pilots and helicopters and a hangar and houses down behind VRD there. And so we've got our little base there. But we work fairly separately, fairly independently from VRD. But there's probably between 10 and 20 people, pilots, and a few, like, office staff, engineers, the cook, a few, like, hanger-oners like me. You know, I'm not... Don't really work for Helimaster, but I don't really work for VRD either. I'm just there as a moral support and because I love it. But, you know, I feel like part of the family because I've lived there for my whole 20s, so I just feel like I'm part of the furniture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a testament to, I think, the group morale at Helimaster. Like, it's a really cool place and really cool people. And I think, you know, the difference between... I'm just going to go on about this for a bit, but the difference between, you know, Helimaster and anywhere else is that everyone has the same, like, everyone's there for a reason. Everyone wants to be there and everyone's excited to, like, take that opportunity on. And I think that when you have a group of people that all have that, like, vibe, it's just a really cool place to be. Yeah, it's a good little community to have, and everyone is so helpful. And, you know, if you need anything, like, you can message someone and say, hey, are you coming from town today on a plane? And they'll be like, yep. And can you bring this for my dog? Because she's got a sore tummy, and within 2 hours you'll have something. So, like, we're so connected in that way because of the aircraft. And, yeah, I mean, you're in the middle of nowhere, but you've got access to everywhere at the same time.
Yeah, that's an incredible way to put it, really. Mm. Like, I've not really thought about how different it would be compared to a station.
Because a station, you really are, like, obviously, if you're on a station and you're 4 hours away, you're not going to be going to town to grab something, or, you know, you're not going to get stuff that you need straight away. But at Helimaster, we've just got that capacity to, people are coming and going all the time from town. So there's just, like, a throughput of stuff all the time. Like, there's a box and you can say, this needs to go to Catherine. And there's, like, literally a cardboard box, and someone will take your stuff to Catherine. Bring it back. And, yeah, it's an amazing machine, how it all functions.
Is there any other research projects you have your heart set on doing within your career? Like, is there certain topics that you really want to do?
Yeah, this is a tricky one because I obviously am pretty heavily involved with mustering helicopter stuff, and I've seen it and talked to a lot of people about it, and I live in it, and I really want to see how mustering impacts calf loss, and or at least, like, the behavioural changes of animals when they're being mustered, and how that sort of integrates with the whole process. Like, there's so many instances where, you know, pilots will have to leave calves behind in the paddock because they've just been born, or, you know, cow won't leave the calf, so they've got to leave them behind in the paddock. And, like, the pilots are always making these decisions, you know, to try and obviously not miss mother and to make sure that calves are not dying and doing all this stuff. So I think it would be really interesting to try and quantify that in a scientific way. Like, you know, even in a small paddock, if you're only getting in a certain number of cows and calves, how many are still in the paddock? And, you know, what 90% is sort of the, I suppose, like, accepted amount of animals that you can muster from a paddock, depending on the country, depending on the vegetation, depending on the day, depending on the pilot, depending on the cattle. Like, there's so many variables. It just would be really cool to kind of see how that all works together. And that's kind of, like, both my spheres, both my worlds and interests kind of interlinked. So
yeah,
that would be cool. But it's going to be, you know, it'd be a really hard project to do. There's so many variables that it would be pretty intense.
Mm.
But yeah, I think there's a lot of uncharted sort of knowledge in there, uncharted territory.
And for someone who wants to get into what you do, research in the territory, how do you even do that as a job?
Well, I think if you have experience in any sort of NT beef production capacity, so if you've done any work in the NT in terms of like data recording or working with cattle in the yards or mustering, or you've done a degree in ag or anything to do with ag, that you've got some sort of territory experience, you'd pretty much be a shoo-in. You don't even need experience in the NT to have a chance either. Like, I think it's just something that you, if you're interested in it and, you know, you've got the qualifications, not all of the jobs need a degree. So a lot of our jobs are just based on like experience. So you can work on a station and then, yeah, we'd be happy to have you on board. There's so many different roles within our little team, but we all kind of do a bit of everything and help each other out. So it's a very inclusive atmosphere.
Thank you, Christy. I know I learned so much from that. We have included a link to her studies in our show notes. If you know of anyone who you think has a great story, please reach out to the Behind the Collective team.